In this final introductory shir to the nature of tefillah, before we jump into the sugyot at the beginning of the fourth parak of Brachot, I'd like to examine, take a little bit of a different direction. Until this point, we focused our attention on the level of obligation of tefillah. Is it a chiv minatura? Is it a chiv midrabanan? In a particular interpretation of the Rambam's view that has mitzvah as a mitzvah tamidit, and we explored that at some in considerable depth, and then exploring the various ramifications in terms of the iser, the level of the iser of eating before davening, and the obligation of women in tefillah. What I'd like to do in this year is to take a little bit of a different tack, although it's also, to some extent, an outgrowth, at least it will intersect with the Rambam-Ramban discussion, but to ask a different question, namely, what is the essential experience of tefillah? What happens in tefillah? What is its essence? What is the act of tefillah in particular? How does it reflect what does that approach to tefillah reflect about the way in which we interact with God? And how can we use, or how can each understanding of the essence or the essential experience of tefillah account for certain key theological questions with regard to tefillah? And just to state the three approaches that we'll develop at the outset, basically, tefillah is meant to change us, is somehow Kabbalistically theurgic. In other words, it is actually meant to change somehow God or change his mind in some way, shape, or form. Or tefillah really is more subtle and goes to the relationship between, the interaction between us and God. It's not about one or the other, but actually about the overall relationship. But before we jump into each of those three approaches and show evidence or various positions in favor of each of those ways of thinking, let's unpack a little bit what I meant by the theological challenges or difficulties with tefillah. This is perhaps most classically spelled out by Rabbi Yosef Albo, the great 15th century Spanish thinker, in his Sefer Ha'ikarim. So as he discusses the various aspects of reward and punishment, remember the Sefer Ha'ikarim is essentially built around the Rambam's 13 Ikarim, and Albo boils them down to three, the third of which is the notion of Schar V'Onesh, and in that context he discusses the nature of prayer. And so in Ma'amar Dalad Perek Yud Ches, and this appears on the source sheets, Introduction to Tefillah number 5, and source number 1. And he writes, there actually is a theological challenge or difficulty with tefillah that led people to ask hard questions. And that which led people to raise doubts with regard to tefillah is similar to what led them to deny the possibility of coming to know God. Essentially, does God decree a particular destiny for a particular individual, or does he not? V'imigzar in sarich tefillah. V'im lo nigzar, ich tovil hatfila l'shanot rison Hashem l'gzor lav tov acher shelo nigzar. Shelo yishnane Hashem min haratzon el lo ratzon v'lo milo ratzon el ratzon. In other words, what is this whole notion of davening? If God has a particular plan in mind for us, then why does davening make any sense? If we're going to cause God to change his mind, does that not imply some sort of imperfection in God's original plan? The whole notion of getting God to change his mind because we daven for it, isn't that theologically problematic? And for that reason, there are those who claim So they deny the implications of our actions on Ashgacha. V'chein, and similarly, Omru, they claim, Shelo tuha tefillah haseg tov ma'olina somi rashi yigzar alav. In other words, because of this, because they want to avoid the conclusion of some sort of imperfection in God, which is manifest in his changing his mind, so therefore they simply deny the efficacy of tefillah. Tefillah doesn't work because we cannot change God. And therefore, a theologically purist approach is to deny the possibility of tefillah being efficacious. So this really is a key problem with regard to tefillah. It's one that was raised by many thinkers. We'll come back to Rabbeinu Bachaye in his Kad V'Kemach, Kad HaKemach. If you take a look at a later source, Rav Cook, in the introduction to his Sidur, discusses this at some length. This is one of the key problems with regard to tefillah. And so the question is, not only how do we understand the essence of prayer, but again, how does each accounting of the essence of prayer explain or begin to address the problems raised by the Sefer HaIkarim? So we had mentioned the three approaches, and let's unpack each one. And in fact, the first approach, namely that tefillah is meant to change us, is indeed the answer offered by none other than Rav Yosef Albo himself. And later on in that same section of the Ikarim, he compares this to tshuva. And essentially he says, that means zehat sad hu shetoil hartz tshuva l'rasha. The way in which the mechanism by way of which tefillah works is essentially comparable to tshuva for a rasha. Shal yidea tshuva hu ki ilu nepach li'ish acher shelo nigzra alav otag zera. So in other words, if I engage in tshuva, it's as if I'm a different person. That original decree did not apply to me because I'm not that same person. You could say this in a more full-throated kind of way, sort of the way that the Rav understood the Rambam's reading of tefillah, where the Rambam also says that you change one of the midarchi tefillah to change your name, kilu ini oso ha'ish. You could take this in the full sense, namely that I'm a new person. That gezeiro was on Yenna, was that other person over there. I'm not that person. I'm Reuven. I'm a new person altogether. Alternatively, you can just simply say that it's not that you're an entirely different person, but the point is that that the decree was made upon a certain individual due to certain negative characteristics, and the point is that once I shed even some of those characteristics, so at least the full gzeira no longer applies, and at least is partially nullified, because I'm not worthy of such negative punishment. And so Rav Albo concludes, so tefillah works in much the same way, or based on an action that I perform, its effect. El shiyuchan hamispalel lekabel shefa hatov o levatal mimenu hara shenik ha'ingzar alav yotom mishtanem mimadrigat haroa sheyihye ba. So in other words, tefillah is much the same. By engaging in tefillah, I become more worthy of becoming the recipient of bounty, of goodness, or I become less worthy of punishment because I have grown religiously. So in other words, tefillah is to engage in a religious growth. And that explains how tefillah works. The reason that it does not imply an imperfection in God is because simply the effect of tefillah is that I am changing. When I daven, I change myself. I become a better person, much as the Baal Tshuva, the Baal Tefillah, is similarly someone who grows through the process of tefillah, and as a result, he or she is deserving of his or tefillot being accepted such that one is subject to a greater reward, receives greater reward, no longer is deserving of a particular punishment. Now, how exactly does one grow through the process of tefillah? So there are many different ways to say this. One classic presentation, it's worth mentioning, is Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch in Chilek Dalet, in the fourth section of his classic work on Ta'amei HaMitzvot, entitled Chorev, it's fairly well known that Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch suggests that the term Lehit Palel, from which tefillah is derived, originally meant to deliver an opinion about one's self, to judge, this is a quote, to judge oneself or an inner attempt at so doing, such as the hit pael, the reflexive form of the Hebrew verb frequently denotes. Thus, it denotes to step out of active life in order to attempt to gain a true judgment about oneself, about one's relationship to God and the world, and the world to oneself. In English, we call tefillah prayer, but this word only incompletely expresses the concept to pray, i.e. to ask for something, is only a minor section of tefillah. True, says Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch, we engage in bakasha, but really the goal of all the bakashot is for us to understand where we are holding religiously, to engage in introspection, lehitpalel, to judge oneself, plilim, to judge oneself, and our own religious standing in the world. True, we ask for certain things and those work. But the growth, that real growth that happens through tefillah, according to Rav Hirsch, is through that act of introspection. For example, one might suggest that the kinds of things that I ask for in tefillah and the degree to which I am able to give shevach and hoda'ah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the goodness in my life themselves are really reflective, are windows upon what my values are. I ask for the things that are important to me. I'm thankful and I offer praise for the things in my life which I value. And so tefillah, if we are self-conscious and self-aware, we're able to gain greater insight to who we are with the ultimate goal, of course, of engaging in introspection and ultimately in terms of religious growth. So I don't know whether Vyosef Albo specifically had in mind anything along the lines of Rosh Hashanah will follow Hirsch, living many hundreds and hundreds of years later, but the basic notion that tefillah is a process of self-growth, one classic variation on that theme is offered by Rav Hirsch. There were others who elaborated the idea of Rav Yosef Albo. So, for example, I mentioned Rav Kook. Rav Kook has a fascinating discussion in his introduction to Sidur, to Olat Re'iyah. And in context of that introductory essay, he really presses on this problem. He explicitly formulates Rav Yosef Albo's problem. I believe he quotes Albo directly. And he really tries to tease out this problem. Because if you think about it, the truth is that Rav Yosef Albo's theory is really incomplete or requires further analysis in order to really fully respond to or adequately respond to the theological problem here. So, for example, if the problem of tefillah is when I daven, how does that work? Isn't that changing God's mind? And the answer is that through tefillah, I am growing religiously and therefore deserving of greater blessing. So, asks Rav Kook, that's very nice if I daven for myself. What happens if I daven for my friend? And isn't that much of tefillah to daven for a chola or for whomever might be in need? Well, wait a second. If I'm changing through tefillah, my friend isn't changing. My friend has no clue that I'm davening for that individual. They're in the dark. In fact, that person, God forbid, may not even be conscious in an extreme scenario. And there's not even a possibility of growth. But at minimum, might not know, or even if they do know. But again, they're not the ones who are davening, who are engaging in this introspection, or according to Rav Hirsch, or whatever exactly is the nature of the religious growth that takes place through the process of tefillah. And as such, the problem is, question is, well, how does that work? And Rav Kook has a fascinating answer that I think is both really worthwhile and yet, to me, La Neostati just smacks as a little bit overly apologetic. Rav Kook suggests, basically says, well, the problem would only be true if we viewed ourselves as atomic beings, but we don't. Well, we believe, and Rav Kook in particular believes, that all human beings, all Jews in particular, are really one larger organism. We're one larger being. We're both individuals, but we're also part of a great chain of Jewish being and human beings. And therefore suggests Rav Kook, when I go ahead and I daven for my friend, so it's true my friend is not changing directly, but I'm growing through the process of tefillah. And since I'm growing religiously through the process of tefillah, therefore, my friend, on some level, is growing as well. This is very much reminiscent of the Ritva's classic explanation for arvos, at least in context of relationship between Jew and a fellow Jew. Right? The Ritva explains why is it that yatsa motzi, and how does this concept of arvos work? So the idea is that if my friend has not yet fulfilled his or her obligation, so on some level, I myself have not fully fulfilled my obligation, because kol yisrael arivim zevazah, and on some level, Klal Yisrael, or the larger organism of Klal Yisrael, has not yet fulfilled our obligation, and therefore, to some degree, I'm still considered to be a mechuyav adavar who is not yet fully yotze yidei chovati, and that's how yatsa motzi works. So it's somewhat akin to that. And Rav Kook actually goes so far as to suggest that on this basis, this is not mukhrach, but I think this is a logical. A notion that could emerge, and for Rav Kook does emerge from his analysis, his presentation, is that Rav Kook says that on this basis that the organism doesn't just work, that we're all equal or equal parts of the organism. He suggests that the deeper the relationship that we have with a friend, the more of an effect that we're able to have on them, because we're more wrapped up with them in the organism of Klal Yisrael. So therefore, if I daven for someone who's distant that I don't really know, you know, like the arrangements that they have. Someone will say kaddish or daven for you. If you give a couple of dollars to kubat a year, right, so this gadol or that gadol will daven for you. So Rav Kook says, that may work, but it's not nearly as effective as if I actually have a relationship with you. If I know you, so then you're considered to be much more bound up with my organism. Not just that I'll daven more effectively or more passionately, with greater authenticity and connectedness, at least most of us will, if we know who the person is. That's not the point. It's more than that. It's that person is changing more through the process of tefillah, is growing religiously as an extension of you, because they're more closely bound up with you. And therefore, if you're growing, they're growing more than someone who's distant from you, and therefore tefillah works for that individual as well. Now, this is, I think it's a very beautiful idea, and really, I think it's very attractive in certain ways. But to me, the notion that the only way tefillah works is because, well, it's not just for my friends, it's not just that I'm changing, but that they were changing as well because of this theoretical construct of Kol Yisrael Arivim Zevazeh, and it raises lots of further questions. And to me, it just seems like a little bit of a kvetch. It just seems a little bit too apologetic in the sense that it doesn't seem to sort of emerge naturally or be the most obvious explanation, and yet these are the kinds of difficult explanations that will need to be offered if we really want to pursue the line of thought presented by the Sefer HaYikarim. I think that's really very much played out in Rav Kook's thinking on this topic. Now, we asked, how does the religious person grow? And we also noted that Rav Hirsch, and as an aside, Rav Kook as well, don't stress that the role of the bakasha inherently as sort of the centerpiece for tefillah, but we know that there is significant reason to do so. In particular, the Rambam highlights it's Shevach Bakasha Hodaya, but it's a Bakasha in the middle. Bakasha occupies the majority of our Shmona Esrei, and even the Shevach and Hodaya sections themselves seem to include a substantial amount of Bakasha. And the Rav in particular really picked up on this and developed this idea of the centrality of Bakasha. And the Rav becomes really, I think, a variation. I've seen it presented in different ways, but to me is a sort of a variation on this notion that tefillah is really an experience of personal growth, albeit through the encounter with the divine. The Rav in particular stresses, especially in his really highly recommended essay, Ra'yonot al HaTzfilah, translated by Rabbi Carmi in Worship of the Heart as part of the Mi'otzar HaRav series. And the Rav really emphasizes the notion of both the incredible chutzpah, the audacity of mere mortal men to approach God, together with even going to the extent of questioning theologically the very ability of the human being to stand before God without somehow being completely enveloped and swallowed up by his all-encompassing presence. So the Rav sort of mixes sort of an ethical and even a metaphysical or existential critique of the possibility or challenge to the possibility of tefillah. On the former, on the audacious and the chutzpah side, the ethical side of things, he quotes a Gemara in Brachot and Daf Lamed Gimel Mabet, the Gemara in source number 3 on the source sheet. Ha'hudi nachas kamid Rabbi Chanina Amar Hakel Hagadol Hagibor Vanora Vehadir Vehizos Vehiro Vehechazak Vehamitz Vehavade Vehnechbad. So this person who got up to David before Rabbi Chanina, he had every single synonym and every single, or specifically not in a precise synonym, every possible characteristic that he could ascribe to God, he did so in an incredibly vocabulary showing as part of his tefillah. So Hinten Lo Adesiyim. So Rabbi Chanina waited until this individual will daven. Kisiyim. So when he finished, Rabbi Chanina said to him, Amar Leih, Siyamtinhu L'chuli Shevchi Demarech. Right? Right? Have you completed all of the shvachim, all of the praises that you can offer your master? Right? Lama li kuli hai, right? Don't waste your time. Anan, hani tzchas da'amrinan, right? And we, the three that we say, hakel, hagadol, hagibor, right? V'hanora, the ones that we say, Ilav Damrinu Moshe Rabbeinu Be'orais, if not for the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu said them in the Torah, V'asu Hakel Hagibor V'hanora, right? V'asu Anshek Nasa Hagdola V'tikninu V'tfila Lo Havinon Yicholim L'Mimar, though we wouldn't have been able to say them anyway. V'ad Amrit Kuli Hai V'azlis. All right, and you're just going on like a broken record. Mashal Melech Basar V'dam Shaluyo Elif Alafim Dinrei Zahav. It is a parable to a human flesh and blood king who possessed thousands upon thousands of dinar of zahav. V'im Kalsin Asov Shal Kesef, and they instead of praising with regard to his gold, they praised him in regard to his silver. And the whole thing is really just a degradation to the king. Similarly, if we offer 30 different characteristics of God, God has infinite characteristics that are worthy of praise. It's just a slap in his face. Better to say the minimum amount only on the basis of whatever Moshe Rabbeinu was willing to say, Nanjik Nesas Agadola signed off on, give their Gishmanka to. That's really all that's appropriate to say. And so the Rav writes in Rayonot Al HaTfilah, here's a translation taken from page 244, and the Rav writes, to the extent that the individual approaches God, his finite mortal existence is negated. This is the second metaphysical critique, or question. The finite is swallowed in the infinite and expires in its depths. Man sometimes flees from God or hides from him, and Moshe hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God, lest he be swallowed. Man's independence and self-confidence are nullified before God's splendor and glory. If so, then the question arises, how can prayer exist at all? Prayer is standing before God, before the divine presence. How can a person be in God's presence without losing his individual existence? Okay, and then the Rav goes on to answer both these questions, and he writes, prayer is a vital need for the religious individual. And here's really where it comes back to tefillah, is ultimately crafting the religious persona. This first approach to prayer. He cannot stop the thoughts and emotions, deliberations and troubles which surge through the depths of his soul, his hopes and aspirations, his despair and bitterness, in short, the great wealth that is concealed in his religious consciousness. It is impossible to halt the liturgical outpouring of these feelings. Prayer is essential. Fresh, vibrant religious feeling cannot exist without it. In other words, prayer is justified by the virtue of the fact that it is impossible to exist without it. For the Rav, it's not so much that prayer changes us as religious individuals. It is that prayer is a necessary outgrowth of what it means to be a religious individual. And the truth is that this is this piece in the Rav's thinking. This is not the be-all and end-all of the Rav's thinking. There's much more here. It's much richer, and there are other motifs that the Rav introduces as well. But Rav Kook makes this point I don't believe it's in his introduction to the Siddur, but I believe he does mention it in his commentary to the Agadata in his Inayan Brachot. And one of the points that he makes, the Gemara in Sugyon Brachot, talk about the connection between Tefillah and Talmud Torah. A person should daven where they learn learn with a daven, a gemara in Brachot and Daf Ched, and then a parallel gemara with regard to Abaye, both with regard to Abaye in Megillah and Daf Chav Tesam and Aleph. Another points of connection between the two, and Rav Kook essentially suggests in one piece that Tefillah and Talmud Torah have actually very different roles to play. That the role of Talmud Torah is to enrich and to grow religiously by connecting intellectually with the divine. Whereas when it comes to Tefillah, Tefillah isn't so much a way of growing religiously, at least in this presentation of Rav Kook, but rather is a reflection. It is a sort of a way of taking the religious temperature of our souls. It reveals who we are, where we are holding, kind of like we were suggesting earlier in terms of Rav Hirsch. And so that's really the tag team of Talmud Torah and Tefillah. Tefillah gives us insight into where we are and who we are, who we have become, and Talmud Torah allows us to take that to the next level and to grow, to begin from that point and to grow from there, which is very much reminiscent of this presentation by the Rav. So the Rav adds theological questions of his own, or two-pronged question of his own. His answer in Ra'anot al Tefillah is, at least in one place, essentially, that we have no choice but to daven, reminiscent of the theme that Rav Amital is sometimes talking about, really both of these ideas, that he would quote the Pasuk Ani Tefillah, or that notion, and that really Tefillah is essential to who we are as people, and drawing from Rav Kook in that regard as well. And number two is really a window to a soul. And if you want to really understand who a person is, Rav Amital would always say, just watch them davening. And that's all you need to know. He'd also quote the story of the Nazir, Rav David Cohen, who came to Rav Kook, spent some time with him learning and so on and so forth, and was certainly very taken, very impressed, but then he saw him sort of cook davening. And he realized that this was his Rebbe. And Masa Shaya Kachaya, so it was for the rest of his life. He never left Rav Kook's teachings, or at his core, he never left Rav Kook's side. Even if physically he wasn't always present with Rav Kook, that Rav Kook's approach to religion and to Torah study dominated who the Nazir became and who he was to be. So we really find this notion of Tefillah as a window into the soul of a person, here for the Rav, Rav Kook, and elsewhere as well. But this is not the Rav's only motif with regard to Tefillah. There's another motif as well, which he mentions and develops in his article published in Tradition in 1978. It was an edition in which the Rav published five articles. They're available for free on the Tradition website. And one of the articles, the Redemption Prayer Talmud Torah. And essentially what the Rav argues in this piece is that Tefillah and Talmud Torah here in the Rav's telling share a different common denominator, and here he doesn't see them so much as only as complements or doing somewhat different things as Rav Kook had suggested earlier, but essentially operating along fairly similar lines. Namely, that both Tefillah and Talmud Torah allow for a person to develop one or to identify. To cut to the core of one's identity and to capture one's own voice. It says that Tefillah, the davening of Klal Yisrael for God to save them in Egypt, was really their own way of finding their voice and therefore finding their identity. Talmud Torah is really not just an intellectual exercise, and it's not just a religious exercise, but it's a way along the lines of the Platonic theory of all learning being relearning. Amniocentesis, or as Chazal put it, the notion that we learn the entirety of Torah in the Malach, meaning that our learning again is something that is second nature to us, and is not is at no point entirely foreign from us, but that's really what tefillah is, and so Talmud Torah is, and so according to the Rav in this piece, again, tefillah enables us to get in touch with our essence, to develop our inner voice, to come closer to our core identity, to recapture it. And the Rav actually considers that to be redemption, and that's the notion of smicha geula l'tfilah for the Rav in this essay, which is essentially redemption. Geula is defined is or tfilah ultimately is the quintessential act of redemption. Redemption is the journey of an individual or a people from the periphery of history, in the case of a nation, or in the case of an individual, from the periphery of my own identity to its very center. And so, and prayer and Talmud Torah are really redemptive experiences in that they allow us to connect with our deepest selves. So these are all different variations on a theme, but whether you hold Rav Hirsch's notion of a self-reflection, whether you hold Rav Soloveitchik's notion that tefillah is an essential need of the religious individual, not only that, but allows us to come to contact with our true essential selves. And this is all the first theory of tefillah. The second tefillah we're going to give much shorter shrift, if only because, in all honesty, it's somewhat beyond me, but I think it has a long and a real tradition or basis in the Jewish tradition. And that is the notion, which for the rationalist is perhaps anathema, but for the Kabbalist is perhaps much more attractive, the notion that it's not to service or to achieve a certain personal individual need, but rather the opposite, that God at some level desires, craves, wants, needs, even if you don't go that far, would like our tefillah, and somehow that's a tzorech gavoah. The truth is, this idea is not something we made up. It's what seems to be the face reading of a couple of Gemara. I'll give just one example. Gemara Nivamos on Daf Samach Dalet Amud Aleph, where the Gemara says, "Am Rabbi Yitzchak Mifnei Ma Hayu Avosinu Akurim? Why were our matriarchs and patriarchs unable to bear children? Mifnei Shakadosh Baruch Hu Misavel L'Tfila Son Shel Tzadikim, because God desires, God craves the Tfila of tzaddikim." A remarkable Gemara. Take it at first glance. At face reading, it really sounds like God desires our tefillot. And the truth is that this notion of God having desires, wants, preferences, whatever it may be, even though, again, for the rationalist, this seems theologically highly problematic and frankly offensive, it's an idea that has deep roots in our tradition, in the Kabbalistic tradition in particular. So the Ramban, for example, in a classic piece at the end of Parshas Tetzaveh, or the end of Perek Chavtes, of Parshas Tetzaveh, of Sefer Shemos, so he discusses the notion as to what it means that that we build the Mishkan so that God dwell in our midst. And he suggests, actually, of all things, on the basis of a comment of Ibn Ezra, that who says that Kilo Hotzesio, some Eretz Mitzrayim, that this particular pasuk on which he's commenting means to say that God only took us out of Egypt, Rapa Avur Kieshkon V'socham, so that God can dwell among them, among the Jewish people. And that is the meaning of the pasuk earlier in the beginning, toward the beginning of Sefer Shemos and Perek Gimel Pasuk Yud Beis, that we are that the intention of Yetzias Mitzrayim was for us to worship God on this mountain. The Yafe Pirish writes the Ramban. The Ibn Ezra in this case got it right. The Imkin Yesh V'Inyan Sod Gadol, says the Ramban, if so, if the Ibn Ezra's interpretation of the pasuk is correct, so then it in fact involves a tremendous secret. Ki kafib shat hadavar, Hashchina b'Yisrael tzorech hedyot v'lo tzorech gavoah. According to the pshat level of explanation, the presence, the indwelling of the Shekhinah among the Jewish people is tzorech hedyot v'lo tzorech gavoah, is a need for us, not for God. How could that be? Aval hu kinyan shemarkas of Yisrael asher v'cha es ba'ar, v'amar Yehoshua ma ta'aseh l'shemcha hagadol psukim rabim ba'ukin, ival l'moshav lo, the guy desired a place to dwell, until in kuflam ebeis po'eshev ki yivisiha, that same parak, v'chaso v'ha'aretz is kor. So in other words, the Ramban suggests the notion that no, that although al pi pshuto, one might have assumed that the purpose of the indwelling of the Shekhinah is for our sake, and that is indeed the thrust of the rationalist tradition with regard to much of the pomp and circumstance surrounding the Beis HaMikdash. The Sefer Chinuch, for example, extensively discusses that the purpose of much of the Avodah, the Korbanot, the Shomrin, the guards who are the mitzvah of Shmirat HaMikdash, are all to turn it into a religious Buckingham Palace that inspires in its best of days, awe and a sense of reverence, in our case, for the divine. The Kabbalistic tradition is represented by the Ramban here, turns the whole thing on its head and says, no, Yivala Moshevo, this is not a Torah Chedio, but rather, al pi Kabbalah, mystically, Sod Gadol, is indeed a Tzorech Gavawa. So it is possible, and if that this is the case, and if we adopt this theurgic approach, in which our tefillah really affect the divine. And by the way, parallel debate about mezuzah, right? The rationalists say that forget this whole shmira notion, the mezuzah is meant to inspire our Yichud Hashem, as the Rambam insists is the purpose of the tefillah. And so he pushes back against the ambulance, and he says that the malachim hachonim saviv la, the angels that surround us and protect us, the mezuzah, actually means the letters of Yichud Hashem that inspire us every time we look at the mezuzah and are reminded to focus on matters of ultimate significance. Others disagree and says, no, the mezuzah really somehow has some sort of effect. There is a theurgic significance. So we find this, of course, not surprisingly, in many different areas, this notion that there's some divine effect, and that's perhaps an alternative theory of tefillah. Of course, the strength of this approach is that you don't have to jump somersaults in order to explain or to resolve some of the theological questions. The reason that it changes God is because God wants to change, and that's okay. And this notion of God being unchanging, perfected, unchanging being is a very nice notion, which is made up by a bunch of Aristotelian philosophers, and that's not the Jewish way of thinking, some of the Kabbalists might suggest. So, of course, this goes to key aspects of medieval theology, but that's certainly the strength of this approach. I think part of the weakness is that this notion is difficult to swallow, difficult to accept, and as the Ramban says, really requires a Kabbalistic worldview. Is this really something that we can swallow? And is Kabbalah really prepared to answer some of the hard questions about the conception of God and what that means, that God has desires, and does it really work that way, and so on and so forth, that seem to emerge from the basic thrust of this tradition. But that would be a second approach to tefillah. So in some, we've seen that it's meant for us, and we've seen the strengths and weaknesses of that position in terms of resolving some of the theological problems. We've seen the opposite approach, that it's really for God. And now I'd like to turn to a third approach, which is not necessarily mutually exclusive in a sense with the other approaches. It's possible that tefillah is meant to affect us and or God, and also to somehow forge a certain more intimate relationship between man and his creator. And the question is going to be, what exactly does that mean? Where do we see this? And can we ultimately use this to understand or to resolve some of the theological problems that we had raised in the name of Rav Yosef Albo at the outset of our shiur? Okay, so that's what we have cut out for us. So if you take a look at source number 8, we'll see an example of this, just an allusion at least to this idea, in the Kad HaKemach Rabbeinu Bachaye, in his counterpart to his Perush al Torah, and Kad HaKemach goes through on the basis of the order of the Aleph these various topics in Jewish thought. And here he writes, and again, there are many points of intersection with his Perush al Torah, and here he writes, Hashem Elokim Tzvakot Shim'a Tfilasi Ha'azina Elokei Yaakov Sela. This is an Erech Tfilah. He's discussing the mitzvah of davening. Excuse me. And plus a pasuk from Tehillim is more paid Talin, and he writes, Pasuk ze amaro David alav ha-shalom. This pasuk was said by David alav ha-shalom. V'hayim mischani la-kadosh baruch hu. He entreated God, shishma tefillah, so that God listened to his tefillah, l'fi she'ima tefillah, because together with, or by way of tefillah, yiskarev adam libor'o. A person comes closer to his master. And what's interesting about this presentation of Rabbeinu Bachaya is that this is specifically in context of having raised the theological problems and about to explore the problems that Rabbi Yosef Alba had mentioned. And his resolution, his notion of tefillah, his theory is lefish ima tefillah yiskarev adam libor. Oh, man comes closer to his, or person comes closer to his or her creator. Furthermore, in the Rambam, the same Rambam who stressed the theory of Bakasha, and the Rav had spent so much attention focusing on the notion of Bakasha. By the way, I should mention, I neglected to mention earlier in context of the Rav, although I alluded to it at the outset of this year, that the Rav's focus on Bakasha really emerges from his analysis of the whole debate between the Rambam and the Ramban. The Rav classically explains, also in Ma'inot al Hatfilah / Worship of the Heart, that really, and elsewhere as well, that really the Rambam and the Ramban are not as far apart as they may seem at first glance. That the Rav focused especially on the Ramban's view that while tefillah on a daily basis is only midrabanan, the Ramban suggests the possibility, and the Rav seizes on this interpretation of the Ramban, that tefillah beitzara is a chiyuv min haTorah. And once he had offered that explanation or adopted work within that reading of the Ramban, the possibility that the Ramban himself raises, so the Rav in turn suggests that the Rambam fundamentally accepts the underlying assumption of the Ramban, namely that tefillah is a chiyuv min haTorah only beitzara. Why is it that the Rambam assumes that there is a chiyuv to daven every single day min haTorah? So the Rav explained that according to the Rambam, that is that a person at his or her very essence, at our core, we have a deep level of, or in other words, deeply seated within us, is a sense of existential crisis, which is inherent to the human condition. So really, the debate in the Rambam and the Ramban is not whether or not tefillah requires an etzara for it to be to generate a chiyuv min haTorah. Rather, the question is, what constitutes an etzara? The Ramban says, an etzara is when there is a terrible illness or something, is about to befall myself or some other individual, groups of individual, there are as an enemy combatant, there are enemy nations that are on the cusp of declaring war against Medina Israel or something like that, and that's the Ramban. The Rambam would say, no, it's constantly an etzara. We always have existential, very profound sense of angst. It's not always evident on the surface and sometimes covered over by other experiences, and yet deep down inside, that is the nature of human experience. And so the notion of Bakasha for the Rav within the Rambam speaks to this notion of the existential angst of what it means to be human. The Rav read this into even seemingly joyous holidays like Purim. The Rav is a relatively sober reading of Purim. We're wearing masks because we don't really get in touch with our inner identity, and our feasting on Purim is only surface deep, it's only external, but internally we're extremely anxious. Akati avdei Achashverosh Hanan, and Purim at night in particular, and Shushan Purim really are not accidental, but are core themes or aspects of the Purim experience, all speaking to this existential angst that lies at the heart of the human condition. And tefillah really speaks to that, and bakasha is therefore so central to tefillah, because that really is very much what it means to be human, and therefore is what we put into our tefillot. So that's just another dimension of the Rav's thinking about tefillah, in particular the inward aspect of tefillah that I think is worth mentioning, that I had neglected to mention earlier. And then to come back, we were discussing Rabbeinu Bachaye and this idea that it's this third approach, Sheit Kareva Adam Levaro. So this idea emerges from Rav Chaim's classic analysis of the Rambam as well. The Rav sees on this too. And that's why I say that different approaches may not be mutually exclusive. The Rambam in Perek Dalet Halacha Tet Zayin of Hilchot Tefillah writes, Kitzad hi hakavana shifne libo mikol machshavot v'yir'eh atzmo ki'ilu hu omid lefnei hashchina. What is the kavana that we speak of in regard to davening, in regard to tefillah? Namely, that a person turn his heart from all away from all thoughts and see himself, view himself as if he stands in the presence of the Shechina. Now, Rav Chaim has an extensive analysis and says, what are you talking about? Mitzvah trichos kavanah. The notion that mitzvah require kavanah means kavanah to fulfill the mitzvah. What are you talking about? And then within tefillah itself, we talk about kavanah samilim, understanding the words. So what in the world is happening here? So Rav Chaim says, aside from mitzvah trichos kavanah, from having intention to fulfill the mitzvah, even aside from that kavanah, there are two additional categories of tefillah, of kavanah with regard to tefillah. So the Rav Chaim writes, in source 10 on the Shivinir Lamar, the tree gavne kavanos yeshbitul. There are two types of kavanah intention with regard to tefillah. Ha'achas, number one, kavanah shel pirush hadvarim, intention with regard to the meaning of the words. I have to understand what I'm saying. V'yisodahu din kavanah, and that's the basic halacha of kavanah. The shenis, but the second one is shechavin shu'omid b'tefillah lifnei Hashem. That a person have intention, as the Rambam writes, that he stands before God. So says Rav Chaim, this is not an additional or separate halacha of kavana. In other words, an additional requirement, an overlay to the core obligation of davening, that it must be accompanied by kavana. No. This is not a kavana, which is an add-on to the act of tefillah, but rather this is a modifier, this is an essential characteristic of the act of prayer proper. If a person does not see himself as aim for God, and he says the words, they're empty words, there's nothingness in tefillah that is not an act of davening. This kavana, as opposed to other aspects of kavana, which are ma'akev, as the sugiyot say, only during the first halacha ma'aseh, only during the first bracha of Shmona Esrei, that's true for kavana samilim. But in terms of kavana shumri lifnei Hashem, that is the essence of tefillah. And so therefore, that's ma'akev throughout davening. I always have to have that intention throughout. The makom shem misasek dino kilo hispalo klal chilu dileg mitzvos milos elu valavale gluni and etzim hatfila. Right, Rav Chaim, that here we don't say, like the Gemara says, that if you don't have kavanah samilim, as Rav Chaim explains it, that it's okay as long as you have kavanah samilim for the hamilim for the first bracha of Shemoneh Esrei. No, lo milifnei Hashem is the essence of tefillah, and therefore is essential throughout. It's not an overly additional requirements of kavanah, but it's me'etzem ma'ase hatefillah, as the Rambam writes. And so what Rav Chaim is saying is that the essential act of prayer is to stand before God, to stand in the presence of the Almighty. And that's not exactly the same thing as saying, I have a relationship with God, but it's pretty close. I'm engaged in dialogue with God. As one person put it, I think there's a lot of insight and further of more to unpack in this suggestion that one sort of the Kriya Shema is a monologue, whereas tefillah is a dialogue. In Kriya Shema we talk to ourselves, in tefillah we talk to God. Put differently, before we talk to God, we need to first speak to ourselves, to have a clear conception of God, of our relationship to Him, of our commitments to Him. Then and only then are we prepared to actually approach Him. So putting Rabbeinu Bachai together with this Rambam, we see this notion that tefillah is essentially an act, according to Rav Chaim's interpretation of the Rambam, it's really an act of a standing before God, and Rabbeinu Bachai would add that it's an act of there through standing before God, perhaps it's an act of coming close to Him. Now, if we have this adopt this approach, that tefillah is not improving myself or improving or changing or fulfilling a need, as it were, of God, but rather is the act of the very encounter itself. And again, these are not mutually exclusive. I can easily suggest through the act of encountering God through tefillah, so we meet a need of God. God craves that relationship. He doesn't just crave empty tefillah. He craves connecting with the tzaddikim who are davening for their wives who are akarot. Or he craves, right? Or another way of seeing it is that through coming close to God, that's how we grow as individuals. And thereby, because we've gone through individuals due to the encounter with God, so Memela as a result, so we change, and so because we change, the result is that our tefillot are more likely accepted, much like tshuva, as we saw earlier in Alba. All those are possible. So these are not mutually exclusive approaches, but I think that they are different focuses, or different foci. And once that's true, so the question is, okay, can this theory really stand alone? Can we use this theory itself on its own to answer the core theological problems of tefillah? And perhaps we can suggest that the answer is yes. And if you take a look at the virtual Beit Midrash, Gush's online website with Divrei Torah, etc. So Rabbi Joshua Amaru has one piece in which he suggests this idea, and he essentially tackles this. It's worth reading in source 11 on our sheet. And he writes, the key to appreciating how influencing God can avoid a mechanistic theurgy on the one hand, the sort of mystical, magical approach, and a travesty of justice on the other, in other words, this notion that, right, why should God change his mind? And what's the difference between then and now is to focus on the intersubjective element of the relationship. In a relationship with another person, one can affect another's behavior in two different ways. One way is by causally manipulating him or her, either by constraining what they can do or by pushing emotional buttons such that they react in some foreseen way. Thus, the pitiable begging of the defendant can influence a judge's verdict against his better judgment. Alternatively, a child can have a public tantrum to get what he wants, causing his parent, desperate to avoid humiliation, to give in against his better judgment just in order to ensure quiet. It's absurd to claim human beings can influence God to act against his better judgment, quote-unquote, in an analogous way. But there's another sort of influence. How we relate to another is not indifferent to the nature of the relationship or to the norms in which it is expressed. This is perhaps easiest to see with parents and children. When the same child asks nicely for the candy, the parent might be inclined to loosen up the rules a bit. No candy before dinner. This is not necessarily the parent acting against his better judgment, but in accordance with it. It's possible to err in the direction of being overly rigid, even in enforcing appropriate rules, while maybe preferable to let things go occasionally. When these occasions are and how frequent they are will be functions of the relationship between the parents and the child. The trust the parent has in the child, as well as the circumstances, will include whether the child is asked for a special treat, how he is asked, etc., all play a role. Chazal understood a person's relationship to God in an analogous fashion. They make use of different images to represent the ways that God relates to the world. Most of them are the images of God as a judge, exhibiting the attribute of justice, the image of God as a merciful father, exhibiting the attribute of mercy. The scandal arises when we presume that justice to be equated with some sort of ultimate rightness, the correct way for God to manage the world. If so, any divergence from that is a scandal. The rabbis did not conceive of justice in this comprehensive fashion. Judgment never allows judgment to diverge from the fair and the just, but God is not really a judge. God, in other words, the way that he relates to us is not in this distant sort of way, but as a parent / judge, but not an inaccessible one, but as really as a parent relates to a child. And so the idea is that we have a real relationship with God. And that is how God chose to reveal himself to us, perhaps because we could not relate to God otherwise. Maybe that itself is a concession, which would not be particularly amenable to the hardcore rationalists. But the idea that God has a real relationship with us, that within the relationship, the confines of a healthy normal relationship, that things can shift, things can change, not through just manipulation, but because there's a certain softness in the rigidity or in the rules of the relationship, can perhaps begin to serve as an accounting for how tefillah works. And that can really be a third approach, which moves away from approaches one and two and stands on its own. And just to close, it's possible to read a comment of Rashi in this way. We mentioned earlier the notion of smichas geula letzvila, of juxtaposing redemption, Gal Yisrael, to Shmona Esrei. Rashi in Brachon Daf Dalam Beis quotes the Rishami, which attempts to explain this idea. And he quotes the mashal of the Ohavosho Melech. To what is such a person who does not fulfill this mandate of smicha gula latila? To what is he similar? To the best buddy, the beloved of the king, who comes and knocks on the entrance way, the doorway of the king. The king goes out in shir hashir in fashion. He finds that the friend ran away. Turned away, Afu Heflig, so God himself, or the king in this case, and the Mashal, turns away as well. Rather says, and that's a tragedy. So says Rashi, in the name Shaliyeh Adam, Mikarev Lakarish Baruch Hu Elav, a person should bring God close to him. Umratzeh B'tishpachos V'kidusin Shal Yitzias Mitzrayim, and to gain, to curry favor through the praises of Yitzias Mitzrayim, V'miskarev Elav, through that to come close to him. V'odu Karev Elav, Yishlo Tfats Rachavim, when you're already close to him, so it's the appropriate time to request one's needs. Now, at first glance, this might be really just a manipulative, kind of crude presentation. I mean, really, smicha skula tefila means, you know, once you've got God buttered up, it's basically foolish not to ask him for something. So smicha skula tefila is basically giving us savvy advice. I mean, you've got to be out of your mind. You've got access to the king. You've praised him. You've buttered him up. You're close to him, and you're not going to take advantage of that moment. You're just going to turn away. Well, if you turn away, your moment's going to be lost, and he's going to turn away as well. So maybe Rashi is just giving us some pretty savvy advice, or maybe not so savvy. In other words, you've got to be crazy not to take advantage of. Who wouldn't ask God for something once you're already there in the inner chambers? You may as well take advantage. That could be. But I think in light of what we've suggested, in light of Rabbi Amaru's suggestion as well, that it's about the interpersonal relationship, and that God manifests himself, according to Chazal, in Achinami, not as a distant, perfected, completed being, but as a real being who, of course, in a theological sense, is perfected and complete, but because he desires a relationship, or because for whatever reason we are meant to have a real relationship with him, he reveals himself not in the manner of a crude, easily manipulated, foolish parents, or uneducated ruler who's constantly manipulated, the strings really being pulled by people in the kingdom, but rather or by the advisors or whomever it may be. But in fact, God is both omnipotent and yet benevolent in his relationship with us, which is a real caring relationship. And so in the confines of that interpersonal relationship, that's where the possibility for tefillah really comes in. And so perhaps that's really what Rashi is saying. What Rashi is describing is basically how a healthy, close relationship works. If a person has a close relationship with the king and goes and knocks on the door but doesn't actually walk in, what kind of relationship is that? So it's only natural for the person to walk in and to have a conversation, perhaps in context of a loving or a close relationship with someone who's the king, to perhaps make a particular request. And so perhaps what Rashi is really doing is he's kind of describing the dynamics of what it would mean to have a relationship with a god, which is on the one hand appropriate for someone who's truly a monarch, and yet for someone who is accessible and engages not only with a sense of justice, but with rachamim, with benevolence as well. So perhaps Rashi is really bringing to light for us in his explanations of Sugula Tefillah on the basis of the Yerushalmi, really this third and final approach. So this is not the be-all and end-all, but I think that this is really food for thought, and there's obviously so much here. But essentially what we've seen is three approaches to the essence of Tefillah, not mutually exclusive. They can interact in all sorts of interesting ways, but that each one potentially could begin to attempt to resolve some of the Tefillah logical problems posed by Rabbi Yosef Albo. Each one has strengths and weaknesses. The third one, it seems to me, is sort of certainly does not work so well with the perhaps the hardcore rationalists, or they may say at least that this is at minimum is really just a concession to human frailty. But I think is really the thrust of so many passages in Chazal, and perhaps the explanation of this final Rashi as well. Have a great day.